You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management, archaeology, and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 146 for September 26th, 2018. I'm your host, Stephen Wagner. For today's show, we're going back to another random encounter episode, except this time we're going to switch genres to be more cyberpunk. So we're doing a cyberpunk edition. So, jack into your decks, because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. Joining me today is Bill in California.
Hello.
And special guest, a different Bill, Bill Ochter.
Hi, from the East Coast. So we could be East Coast and West Coast Bills.
Oh, that'll work well.
I like that.
Okay. So for today's episode, we're doing another random encounter episode. We did a previous episode, which we'll dig up and put in the show notes. That one was a little bit more D&D focused and with a kind of a fantasy setting. And the way that these work is we have a list of topics, and Bill Ochter, East Coast Bill, is going to roll a die and pick a topic, and we will relate it back to CRM archaeology. Bill is, if you follow him online, he's no stranger to role-playing. Bill, do you want to talk about your D&D stuff?
Yes. So since the last time I was on, I've started a group of a Dungeons & Dragons game, sort of mostly online, with other mostly CRM archaeologists here in sort of the Middle Atlantic region. Right now, we're sort of playing conventional D&D because for a lot of us, we're trying to learn the game as we go along. But sort of one of the long-term goals for this, and hopefully I can report later down the road, we're trying to make things a little more archaeology-focused within the game, sort of explore some of the themes, theories, practices of archaeology within a fantasy setting as sort of a way of sort of educating the public about archaeology. So it's playing around with that right now.
Sure. So it's you're kind of doing an archaeogaming sort of thing, but analog.
Yeah, it's a very much an analog archaeogaming sort of experiment at this point. And I'm excited to see where we end up with this. Hopefully we'll actually get to play for the public at some point, whether it's a podcast or at a convention or something like that. But first, we have to learn how to play the game.
Cool. So, West Coast Bill, do you know how to play this game?
I know how to play D&D, but I don't really know how to play this game. However, I have all the cues, so maybe if you guys go first, I'll be able to figure it out.
Okay, well, and also for the audience, the way this works is we have a list, in this case, of 10 cyberpunk-themed topics. East Coast Bill is going to roll a die, pick one, read it off. They don't actually know what the topic is because it's all metaphor on the random table. We'll have a link to that table and on the show notes. And then I will read off the actual question, the actual theme. Both Bills will have to think quick, come up with an opinion, which shouldn't be too hard for any of us. And then just have a few minutes to talk about it before we move on to completely the next topic. East Coast Bill, are you ready to roll?
Okay, let's do this. Let's see what we get. All right. So according to the information on the CRT screen here, we are going to have some information overload.
Information overload.
Well, this is something we deal with all day.
Oh, wait. You haven't heard it. Okay, here we go. So information overload. As time moves forward and we're moving into the 20th century, the ubiquity of material culture is becoming more and more of an issue. So how do we work with this? How do we work with just the sheer amount of stuff that's out there having been created and disposed of in the 20th century? West Coast Bill, since you already started talking, you can pick this up.
Yeah, so I guess the question is how do we deal with all the stuff that we've already dug up? I don't really even know where to begin on that one. One thing that has been advertised all day and all night is reusing the collections that we already have and trying to go back through them. If you have the money and the collection is right, I think that's a good idea. But a lot of times what ends up happening is you have to recatalog and redo all the other previous work because either there's important pieces missing or it's not in a format that you can actually use in the present because it was dug up, 40 or 80 years ago or something like that. So I guess going back to the information overload, when it comes to the artifacts, those are still there as long as they haven't been soaked in formaldehyde or DDT or something like that. We can still access them. However, the information that we already have a lot of times is flawed or can't even really be used. So as far as information overload, in some ways, some of that old information actually is not applicable. And so then we end up having to add more information, adding more information to the overload. So, going back to the collections example, I'm not really sure what we're going to be able to do about that. And actually, a tragic problem is a lot of this information that we use to analyze or record sites is within this context where it's 40 or 50 year old information about an archaeology site, and you get the site form and it's seriously about two paragraphs that just say prehistoric site, six sherds, here's where it's at, and then there's a pixelated crummy copy of some kind of map that's supposed to tell you where it's at. There's no UTMs. There's no real northing or easting. It just tells you what 7.5 USGS quadrangle you're in. And so a lot of the information that we have is actually not good or not really usable. As far as overload, there's a lot of it. So not only do you have to go through this old information to sort out for any kernel of quality quality data you can use, but you also have to sift it and get rid of the stuff that you can't really use. It's really time consuming. I don't really know how to handle the information overload. Maybe you guys have some better insights than I do.
I mean, so thinking about it, like one of the things I think about when I come up with this is that we need to ask better questions to sort of go along with the idea of we have this sort of data corruption, for lack of a better term, trying to keep it cyberpunk themed, that this older information we have is in the light of our current era, incomplete, insufficient in a lot of cases for it to even be usable, to debate whether or not it's even worth the effort of trying to retrieve it and trying to make it more current. So a big thing I always think about with this thing is like, What is the purpose of going back to these things? What are the important questions? There are definitely areas when you're talking sort of meta-analysis now that are sort of available on a regional or national basis, which have a lot of promise, but we run into the same problem we did before. We had a site form that mentioned a site with an incomplete location, and we mentioned there were five flakes found. How good that data is for a real meta-analysis is sort of really up in the air. Also, just now thinking about this, this is a direct sort of cyberpunk idea, and the fact that we have a lot of computer information now that is now 30 years old, and trying to preserve, archive, and access 30 year old basic files, which might have rudimentary tables on them and so forth like that. How much effort should we put into that for sort of that digital archival preservation? Because as we keep moving forward and we keep doing things more digitally, digital archiving is going to be even more important than it is now. And how do we preserve that for future use? So, interesting questions.
Cool. So you want to roll for the next one?
Okie dokie. All righty. So now we are now going to shift our view up a little higher and discuss corporate states.
Corporate states. Are we hired to tell the client no, or just to help them navigate the system? Does the system allow for showstoppers?
I mean, the short answer is yes. As CRM, I mean, the way this, the system, especially in the United States, the way the system is set up is that we are acting as pseudo agents of the government, but being paid and hired by the private interest involved in exploring the questions of the cultural resource impact under the case. And within the United States, it's typically the one who pays the bills which has the final say on the services delivered to that person. That doesn't mean we can't and we don't try to do good science and good stewardship on there. But in the end, you know, the reality is we are sort of bought by the corporate interest.
So do you think there can be showstoppers? I mean, is there a way that the system allows for us to say no?
Yeah, our whole job is to give professional recommendations. And it's the same as if, we try to make parallels to other fields like law and medicine or whatever. But if your doctor tells you that you have, a lifestyle-based disease, you know, and I can't point one out. I guess maybe alcoholism. If you have a lifestyle-based disease and your doctor says, this is destroying your life, you really need to stop drinking. And then you don't get the help and you don't at least try, right? So I know drug addiction is not a just open and shut case, but if you get the information that, you know, your life is going to be damaged or you're going to suffer greatly if you continue on this path, and then you don't try to stop, then you're going to seek the, you know, end result, right? So that's the thing with our recommendations. If we recommend that they don't destroy this, important archaeological site, and then we file our paperwork like we're supposed to, and then they continue to proceed down that path, and the, you know, SHPO backs us up, or others within that agency or company say, you know, this was the right recommendation. You really need to listen to this. And then some people decide to go forward. They will suffer. Now, is it going to be them getting sued into the ground and, you know, run out of business? Probably not. In some cases, it could end up that they lose contracts, that important stuff happens, and then they're, you know, out of the way or whatever. But I understand how it seems like maybe we don't have the agency to tell them no, but I've worked for companies where our PIs did say no, and they drew a line in the sand. And if the client had gone forward, they would have suffered, you know, whatever penalties. It could have just been a slap on the wrist, or it could have been something that actually impacted their business. So I believe we have the agency to say no.
So in those situations, what was it, a situation where there was no way to mitigate out of it? Like you couldn't like move the building or excavate the site or something?
So one that I'm thinking of is there was a site. The site doesn't know about property boundaries, right? So there's archaeology on two sides of a property boundary. One property administrating. Oh, and they were both owned by a private company. The land was owned by a private company. However, the project was being administered by two different agencies, right? One was a large national government. Federal government agency. The other one was a local agency, right? So the property owner, the person who actually owned it, the corporation that owned it, was just saying, well, this doesn't come off of our payroll. You guys are the ones who are leasing this property and doing the construction on it. You know, whatever they say, it's no big deal to us, right? So they were kind of like, we're out of this. Talk to the agencies. The local agency was down with following the regulations, what they were supposed to do. And, you know, they were just saying, do the data recovery. The other agency kept trying to say that because the site was on the state agency side, then it doesn't have to do anything because that's all on their side. But, you know, we were explaining that, you know, the site, it exists, whether there's a arbitrary property boundary or not. Well, that agency just kept pushing and pushing and saying, well, that site is on their side. And so they have to take care of the piece that's on our property. And we were kind of saying, I mean, I guess if they'll agree to it, however, they're not going to, and this entire thing is going to get slowed down and problems are going to happen if you don't let us do the data recovery on the other side of the boundary. So we started the data recovery through one agency, through one, you know, funding situation. on the state property side. And, you know, the boss kept going back and forth. Well, they decided, you know what, we'll just protest this to the advisory council. And so they went to the advisory council, and the advisory council was like, no, the site is on both sides. There's nothing we can do. The archaeology exists. You know, you're liable for whatever penalties. You really should just do the compliance, right? At the same time, the state decided, all right, well, we'll just solve this problem by giving it a different site number. And so they gave the other half of the site that was there, you know, on the state side, they just made it like part A and part B, and said that part B was on the federal agency side. It was saying, okay, now you have your own site and it's just on your side. And the advisory council says that that site's on that side. Now, I don't know if the movement to have an A and a B really actually did anything. But really, the advisory council, by saying that you must do the compliance, it's on your property, and whatever the site name is, and even if it's consistent across boundaries, it doesn't really matter. You still have to do it. Well, that individual decided that they still weren't going to do it, and so they went to their legal department of their agency, and that person was saying, well, you know, we're just going to suffer penalties and all this other stuff if you don't do it. Okay, so the bulldozers are moving closer to the site, and on one half it's done, and the construction company just essentially can't get it done. So the state moved to sue the agency and was saying, our transportation project's going to be slowed down if you guys don't do this. And then magically overnight, we ended up having to do compliance on that. And they continued to be a thorny client all the while, but that was a case of where my bosses just were not going to, they weren't going to move on it. It was an important site. And they just got the data recovery. I mean, this took multiple years, but it ended up happening. And that was a case where the bosses just wouldn't budge on it. They didn't fold.
Oh, that's weird. That's a really complex situation.
Yeah, it's a pretty sweet site.
Yeah. So that's the first segment. After this break, we'll return and select some more topics and talk some more. See you after the break.
Hey, podcast fans and digital archaeologists. Have you heard about WildNote? It's a data collection app that works online or offline on your smartphone or tablet, iOS or Android. It allows you to collect field data easily, manage data efficiently, and generate data reports and site records effortlessly. We have a growing list of state site forms built in for your use and some generic forms that will work anywhere. Check out the shovel testing and photograph forms. You can get a free all-access 30-day trial today by going to wildnoteapp.com. That's wildnoteapp.com for your free 30-day trial. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to the CRM Archaeology Podcast. We're having another random encounter episode, this time with the cyberpunk theme. East Coast Bill, would you like to roll the die and choose the next topic?
All right, let's go see what we're going to jack into this time.
That'll be the cyberspace deck.
We are going to now explore the social credit system.
Oh, man. I really like this one. And it's barely even cyberpunk. I'm sure you've seen the news recently about China doing a social credit system where basically because you're constantly being monitored by various CCTVs and just, you know, the sheer amount of data that they're tracking people with, that, you know, if you do good things, you get good points. If you do bad things, you lose points. And you have a social credit rating that affects how, basically, you know, what you're able to do. You know, it, like if you have too low of a score, you get excluded from things. If you're doing really well, you're, you know, held up as a model citizen. So in terms of that, for CRM archaeology, you know, had me thinking about unpaid labor. And you know, we go to conferences, we publish papers, we interact with local societies and do, you know, volunteer type stuff with the public, to, you know, do public education and stuff like that. How much of this do we need to do to build up our essentially social credit as archaeologists? Like, can we not do any of these extra credit things and still be considered a good archaeologist? Do we have to do this? What do you guys think?
Well, I mean, I'm thinking about it, and it's sort of where, when I think about archaeology, I always think of that we were sort of wearing two mantles. We're the professional, the one who goes to work, who does a job, who gets tasks and gets an income based upon that. But also archaeology itself is also a vocation. It's also a sort of an identity of, or can be, of who you are. And with that identity, so a lot of these things we talk about are the kind of things, if we left CRM, we still might be doing. We still might be volunteering for a dig on the weekend. Presenting might be a little harder to do. But some of these non-paid things are still some of the things we might be doing, even if we are not doing day-to-day archaeology, because we've taken that as sort of an identity type of vocation. So on one aspect of it, I see it as sort of a natural fit, that there's just naturally going to be those types of things we do, which are going to be sort of in the unpaid realm. And they are more for your sort of self-growth, your self-fulfillment. In the same way we do volunteering and charity to help with the public in that aspect, we're doing this to sort of help educate the public. Can that be abused? Absolutely. When you're at a conference presenting on behalf of a company and you're giving that company credit and exposure based upon your work, should you be compensate in some way for sort of helping to market that company? Yes. And some of these things do have crossover in that aspect where, yes, you're doing something to sort of be helpful and to reach out to the public. But another entity, a for-profit entity, is also benefiting from your actions on that. And so I would think that there should be looked at in some ways. But I still lean on the idea that, I mean, it's the kind of thing we would do for those of us who've been around CRM for long enough without it. But I also think you don't have to. I've known plenty of archaeologists, good long-term, 20-plus year seasoned people who don't do any of this stuff. They just, you know, go to work. They do their projects. They write their reports. They'll talk about it at the bar afterwards. But you don't see them at conferences. You don't see them at public events. But I still think that they're just as important to our industry and our field as those who are out there on social media, making their presence felt at conferences and other places, sort of reaching out.
Cool. West Coast Bill.
Well, this is one that it's pretty interesting because after I was not a field tech anymore, they never let me be hourly again. Because I think everybody knew I was going to end up doing more work than would ever be noted, right? So I go back and forth on this one because, so if you comply with the social credit system and you do that free archaeology, you're doing a lot of that stuff in your hotel room at night, you are going to conferences and you are doing, public outreach or whatever that they're not paying you for, then you're a team player. And many companies like that, right? In the end, is that going to keep your job all the time? No, it's probably not going to keep your job all the time. But just like East Coast Bill was saying, we got into a career that our identities are entwined with the actual work that we do. So it's difficult for us to stop reaching out and doing the extra thing. So, you know, I don't know if the social credit system is good or bad, because it already just is part of archaeology anyway. And those who are doing the extra stuff, a lot of times they have a bigger network. People think that they're a team player. They know they're going to go the extra mile. And those are the people that when, you know, it's time for projects to happen, they actually just hire those individuals. You know, they hand in a resume, but it's kind of a formality because they know that they're going to go the extra mile and make this project a success, right? The other people who have been doing stuff for 20 years, the only way that they would be top dog in any kind of hiring system is if they were well known for good work. So if a lot of people actually already knew that they did good work and they were, you know, they had been on many projects, and then this individual's resume comes across the table and other people stand up and say, oh yeah, yeah, she's great. You really should hire her. She's a solid person that, you know, has a lot of experience and handles herself really well in the field and also can help in the office and stuff. So that person will end up getting hired because other people know them. However, other people who maybe, aren't necessarily known for their work, but go the extra mile and stuff, a lot of times they can build the network that helps them get hired, whether they're good or not. And then just the whole credit system, I'm afraid of that kind of thing anyway, because it can be the pathway towards you being a doormat, where magically it's just expected that at night you're going to do, you know, 80% of the paperwork, quality checking and making sure everything works. And they're not going to pay you at all in your salary. So, you know, your pay goes from, you know, $30 an hour, or $25 an hour to like 10 or 12, because you're putting in like 14-hour days, essentially, between drive time that they're not paying you for and all the free archaeology you're doing at your hotel room and just basically never being off the clock. You know, I don't know. I think that there needs to be some kind of a balance, right? Because some of this stuff's not going to get done. Like you were saying, volunteering at sites on the weekend, that's just not going to get done because no company's going to pay you. And the only reason you're volunteering is because someone has a research project or a state agency isn't going to pay for the compliance or whatever. So you're doing that out of the generosity of your own heart and your affinity for archaeology. When it gets to be doing paperwork and editing reports and submitting proposals and writing levels of efforts in your hotel room after a 10-hour day, I think that's kind of abuse.
Sure. And when it makes me think about kind of the labor requirements of like grad students, that we expect an awful lot, and then they all but disappear once they get like day jobs because they have day jobs and nobody can really keep up that level of output. Anyway, moving on. Shall we roll for the next one?
Okay, let's see what we got now. This is me trying to read this one. Okay, so we're going to come up with virtual Adoru. I'm probably saying that wrong.
Adoru.
Yeah, I definitely need you to explain this one because I couldn't even figure it out through Google.
Yeah, that's number four. Okay. It's kind of a play on Idoru, which is the Japanese word for idol. So a virtual idol. Do the program structures of cultural historical categories warp our perceptions of the people and places we're studying?
Yeah, I've seen it happen before where there's some archaeology sage that 80 or 90 years ago wrote the capstone culture history on a certain area, and everybody keeps hearkening back to that, but no one actually looked at any of the notes or the methods or anything. They haven't really focused on how those things were excavated. And you know, we have these culture histories that were made by individuals who just dug straight down in arbitrary levels or just hogged things out and then tried to put it back together and stuff later on. And even though they were written before any of us got there, I think our excavation strategies a lot of times are more nuanced, but clinging to that, I think a lot of times that can shape how people feel. The other thing that shapes, and I was talking about this the other day, the other thing that shapes us that kind of goes into that whole idol thing is the shout out paragraph or the shout out page, where every single peer-reviewed journal article or book has this just, you know, kind of I don't know. It's a weird section where it just lumps every scholar who's ever talked about this. You know, every person who's ever talked about Caribbean stoneware bottles, they just have this page where it's like, you know, people have studied this based on personal identity and networks and this and commerce. And after every noun is this list of scholars who have all written, and then it's understood that you will make sure that you, you know, write one whole paragraph or a couple sentences about the coolest scholar in that area that a lot of times is the one who wrote the, you know, most cited item, whether it's good or bad or whether it's old or new. You're just going to write all this stuff about it. Sometimes I do think that shapes us, because by having that shout out paragraph or that shout out page, it keeps us in that old mindset where we're not really able to talk about the new piece until we've given homage to the old. And a lot of times the old is actually something that we've moved way beyond.
But it isn't part of that, you know, just demonstrating our familiarity with other people's approaches on the same data set.
Yeah, but in CRM reports, we just put a table. Previous projects in this area, here they are, all one table, and then we move on from
there.
But
a table doesn't demonstrate that you've actually read them,
yeah,
right?
But a shout-out page doesn't either.
Oh, sure.
And this sort of goes to sort of my idea on this, is my sort of bugbear on this, is it's the pre-contact and historic context that we often put in these reports. These, you know, can be 20, 30-page sort of histories, which sort of incorporate a lot of the information that's in those shout-out forms, because you will be distinctively asked, you know, did you cite this person? Did you cite this one in that? And while it's a larger format and it's more narrative, so you would think it's a way of sort of demonstrating, in reality, it's often cookie cutter. It often looks the same from company to company. Throughout there, from report to report, so it's in itself isn't really isn't always a demonstration of the context of a region of a place. It's more of a, did you show off? Did you look at the right bona fides for that? Did you give proper deference to the right people in the past for an area where it could be? And often I try to, when as much as possible, summarize those things in tables. I've had, you know, my favorite, you know, my normal go-to pre-contact when I can get away with it is a single table, which sort of sums it up. And then I add my new information, which is relevant to the particular project I'm working on. But a long multi-paragraph discussion of fluted points of the Delaware Valley don't necessarily mean anything to a project on the western side of the Chesapeake Bay, unless I start finding fluted points. So I don't need to have that big discussion to do that. But out here, we often find ourselves writing those big, grand regional narratives before we sum up. And
general to specific, it's the old story. Start general with the, you know, cooling of the Earth's crust, and then move on from that. Or start with this entire state, half of a state, and then dial it into your area.
Yeah. What is the Carl Sagan quote? If you want to know how to make an apple pie, first you must invent the universe, or something like that.
That sounds about right.
So for your cultural context, you were talking about, like, well, this doesn't really necessarily apply to the area you work, the side of the river valley you're working on. Do you customize it at all, or do you just let it go?
Well, you definitely customize it, but often it includes, you start off with the super general, the super post-life, you know, Pleistocene, the last Wisconsin maximum of the ice age. Because with the general knowledge, you have to go wide because you don't have as much specific a lot of the times. So, I mean, I get it on one level. Like, if you're writing a book, if this was a one-time discussion, which I guess the way these things are written, that they're seen as that, a one-time discussion. But when you're seeing report after report after report that sort of all begin the same way, there seems to be a balance of labor that could be used differently.
Well, and, you know, one of the thoughts that I've had with context is, you know, not just summarizing, but it helps to identify, like, you know, what are the potential research questions here? You know, like, and using it to describe not just, you know, here's the cultural use of the landscape, but, you know, these are the potential things we could be finding, and you know, it should shape your methods.
A proper context should be, the purpose of a context should be to identify those potential questions. That you're going to, hopefully your research will set to answer. It's just that, I guess my little gripe was on the ones that don't seem to serve that purpose, but seem to be more serving that I've looked up the right people and I am saying the conventional wisdom, rather than setting up setting up your research questions, where this is not just a sort of box checking. This is a new research, and this is sort of the basis that I'm building this new research on.
I think the other thing that goes unacknowledged is that sometimes these things that we give shout outs to were generated from crummy field methods, digs that had no research design, excavations that God knows how anyone got any of that data, but these are, you know, foundational data sources that we're using as our documents. So I don't know. I mean, with the CRM stuff, a lot of times we have standardized methods that we use in the field, but the peer-reviewed journal articles that we're citing, a lot of times, God knows how they got that information.
Right. Well, I'm afraid we're out of time on that topic. It's time for a break. After the break, we will pick another couple of topics and wrap up the show. See you then.
This network is listener-supported. We're trying to move away from paid advertising while also creating new shows and supporting the ones we have. The APN has never and will never make a serious profit on our podcast. Every little dime we make goes back into the network and improving show quality. So become a member today at www.arcpodnet.com/members to show your support, get some extras, and be a benefactor for archaeological education. Members get stickers, a coffee mug, a t-shirt, bonus content, early access to episodes, a private Slack team to talk to other members and the hosts, and full access to training on Team Black over at arccert.black. So check out our memberships at www.arcpodnet.com/members today and support archaeological education. That's www.arcpodnet.com/members. The Archaeology Podcast Network has partnered with TeePublic to bring you some awesome gear that looks good, promotes archaeology, and puts a few pennies in our pockets so you can get free podcasts. Check out our designs at arcpodnet.com/shop. That's arcpodnet.com/shop.
Welcome back. We are starting the third segment for the Random Encounter episode, Cyberpunk Edition. East Coast Bill, they're both named Bill, so bear with me. Would you roll the die and give us a new topic?
Okay, let's see. I just jinxed myself because I just thought, you know what? We haven't had a duplicate yet. And we still don't. Instead, we have ourselves a holographic Simulacra.
Simulacra. I think it's all the book learning. I don't know how to pronounce that either.
Always pronounce it wrong.
Okay, and this is one. It's had many heated discussions on Twitter. And so I thought it was a very good one because it's kind of about the reality of the past. And the question is, does the past exist?
No,
maybe.
Okay, moving on. do you want to elaborate, either of you?
All right. So I think of the past in the same way that I think of other sort of socially constructed institutions, such as governments, religion, economies, in that are they real? Do they have an actual impact upon us in the world today? Yes, absolutely. Are they physical beings, physical structures that you can touch and feel? No, no. Well, what we dig out of the past are things that are products of today, which we tell a story of a longer time period on them. But we are interacting with objects today. We are not interacting with objects of the past or in the past, as it were. So that's always the filter we have to look at, which is why archaeological interpretation can change over time, why we can relook at, to go back to sort of the first topic, relook at old collections and things like that and see them differently. It's because we are, in reality, interpreting our present through objects of the past. With that, at least I see that that's a lot of the work we do, is that. So that's where my maybe comes into play. It's going the whole, I'm using the socially constructed crutch.
Sure. West Coast Bill.
Yeah. So this is going to get us all into trouble, but if you, it depends on what kind of, understanding of the universe that you're using, but in the understanding of the universe that we use for archaeology, traditional, you know, archaeology, post-processual or processual archaeology, then there is only the present, and we are, you know, as rightfully stated before, we're interacting with things that were created in the past, in the present, and then we're, you know, curating them in the present, and then in the future, we look at things that were already done in the past. However, we engage with them still again in the present. if you don't believe in that, if you have a different worldview or a different universe, see, here's where we always have problems with indigenous communities, right? Because some of the ones that I have spent the most time doing archaeology with don't believe that. They believe that the spiritual world and the world of humans and the world of all the other beings and organisms exist at the same time and in the same place. So if you're at one place, all of those things, the different planes of reality, are existing at that location, including activities that happened in the past. So the past and present and everything are all happening in one space at the same time, that there is no past, present, and future. There's just all things existing wherever you're at. You can perceive them in that location, and they go back as far as you can in timeline, and they go forward as far as you can. So, you know, we have difficulties.
I don't want to put you on the spot here, except I'm about to. You know, one, you keep using the word past, though, when you're talking about that. And two, like having that there is, like, if everything's happening at the same moment, in that perspective, how do you work with that with traditional archaeological reasoning then? Like, you know, how does that affect, you know, our notions of like stratigraphic deposition? And I mean, how can you account for that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, we use archaeology, so we have to exist in the present, right? But yeah, so then how do you convey these ideas to individuals who have a different understanding of the world, right? And then also, how can we understand their worldview when we live in the one that's so natural to us? I mean, I don't know. It's a lifelong quest, really, for a lot of archaeologists.
Yeah, I mean, I see that as sort of very fifth dimensional thinking. Like, if we are three dimensional people, we look at a piece of paper, which is two dimensional. But if you were on there, you couldn't visualize the 3D world, but we can see the entire 2D world at once. If you step back to the fifth dimension, you can see the fourth dimension, which is time space.
Well done.
See, I'm very sci-fi influenced now because of our themes today. And so so within a scientist or scientific or positivist way of interpreting that, which of course itself is now, you know, we run into questions of sort of an appropriation, because that is not what West Coast Bill's talking about. West Coast Bill's talking about a completely different ideology built in a completely non-Western system. So I'm now jumping onto myself, which could be a different topic for a different day. And maybe is a topic about how us as sort of Western scientists are interacting with these other ideologies.
Well, and you know, just to kind of go back to my question, Bill, it does, I think it would be an interesting topic in that, you know, how do we deal with archaeological interpretation or historical interpretation of, you know, like our chain of events, right? If that's not actually like a logical pathway, like does that negate all those arguments, or can you work with that?
I mean, I've dealt with those sort of questions a lot when I was doing my grad school, and when I can't now, dealing with like a lot of like enslaved populations in the antebellum Chesapeake region. I did a lot of my work in that. And with that sort of study, the idea, the questions of things like agency come into play, and to try to discover the agency of the people of the past, sort of this voiceless population that exists and that don't exist within historical record. How can we use archaeology to give voice to that? Which is a very loaded and a very tricky subject, and I will most likely be stepping on some landmines right now, because there's no way of not doing that when you're discussing this out there, because there are multiple competing interests at that point. There are the interests which want to keep the narrative, as it were, as we see now in this country. There's a sizable sort of, there's a very much a lost cause narrative this would still exist in this country. The idea of the sort of benevolent South still has favor among those who are both the public and sometimes the patrons of archaeology. We have other sides which want to come up with a modern liberation narrative that fits along with sort of the contemporary view of identity and so forth, and sort of look for that in the past. where that model doesn't necessarily work because the people of that time and that place are not using the ideological structures that we do nowadays to discuss identity and place and person. And with the concepts of race and heritage and things like that mean nothing to the people of those time periods. So trying to look at them through that. So it's always been a tricky subject. I mean, I think when I did my thesis, my grand conclusion was my giving agency to this one enslaved girl that I was studying as sort of my focus in this study was, I the best I could do is acknowledge that she existed. And then any other statement beyond that was going to be some sort of interpretation of me today imposed upon her, and then resubjugate her again through sort of intellectual devices. So
that's pretty insightful, man.
Yeah,
that's pretty insightful.
Yeah, there's a lot there. Like with most of these topics, we could probably do an entire episode on any one of them, but. We're only doing short topics today, so we need to move on to the next one. Bill, do you want to roll?
All right, for the last one. Big money. No whammy. No whammy. We have somehow rolled... I'm going to first give myself credit that I rolled different numbers for each time for this. I'm patting myself on the back. So this time we are going to explore vat-grown ninja clones. You know, like two Bills on the same podcast.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, yes. I wanted this one badly.
Okay. Here it is. and I'm going to apologize to everyone because this is it's kind of an insulting metaphor, but it's a metaphor for how CRM as an industry treats field techs. So our field techs trained specifically to fill just a single niche. Can they do anything more than that? And how do they move on beyond what they're essentially created for?
Yes, no, maybe.
Let me think about that for a second. The idea, if you as a new professor, I'm learning that there's a range of values of professors and what they're teaching and why they're teaching. There's a cadre of individuals who are just teaching their research that they are very interested in and they know a lot about. And it's not really supposed to be something for students to use for the future ever. It's just for them to expand their own understandings of one topic, right? And anthropology is no stranger to that. So you take these classes and they're directed on an area. And then the way that the stuff is taught, it's not for you to know more about something you would ever use in the future. It's for you to just know more. There's other professors who think that they're preparing students for the concentration in which they actually are in. So in the case of archaeologists, there's professors who believe that they're training students to do archaeology, and many of them actually are, but not all of the people in that class want to be archaeologists. And then also not all of them will go on to be archaeologists. So it's great that people are learning the things that they'll need to know as an archaeologist. However, many are not ever going to go on to that. And then there are some people who believe that they're training their students for CRM, and there are a small number of professors and programs doing that. And those folks try their best to prepare students for CRM. But then once again, not all those students are going to go on to archaeology. Not all will go into CRM. And then there's a group of individuals who think that they're training the next generation of graduate student, right? So they're trying to teach them all the stuff that they need to go to that higher level of intellectual practice. And so in that range, you could be a student and you could get professors all along that spectrum. You could be like me and there was a couple of professors as an undergrad that were really useful that, did try to prepare me to be an archaeologist. They never mentioned CRM in class, but they tried to get me the tools I need to be an archaeologist. I'm really grateful for those folks. There was other folks in my department who taught me nothing that I would ever need, like ever. And the entire course was designed for them to talk about their own research. which, you know, a lot of times they didn't even talk about their own stuff. They talked about a bunch of other stuff that other people did in the area where they want to work or they do work or something like that. So I got a mixed bag, and it was really on the job training that got me to be a field tech, not really stuff that I learned in college.
Sure. And when you were going down your list, I was thinking that, you know, more from the employer perspective of, you know, it's, I mean, that's essentially what employers want, is they want, you know, a ready to go ninja out of the vat, you know, just, you know, hand them a shovel and drive them out to the site and let them loose. East Coast Bill.
So, I mean, to sort of take this to the next level of sort of like, once you are the CRM field tech, and expectations and so forth. Sort of my thoughts are like, you know, like a lot of firms, a lot of places are looking to fill billets. They're looking to fill slots. Right now, you know, I'm thinking of a project coming up soon, which would be multiple companies sort of working together as contractors under a grand federal agency contract. And so you're looking to fill in slots. I need a crew chief. I need X number of field techs on there. And with that in mind, you're looking to fill those roles. You're looking for someone who can do the task, whether it's a phase one, dig shovel test, East Coast, we're always digging shovel test, phase two or three. So there's going to be test units involved. Can they do that? At no point, I wouldn't say no point, but most of the time you're not thinking, well, this person's pretty good at digging shovel test. I've worked with them before. I could train them up. To do, you know, the next thing. They can't quite do block excavation to the way we need it right now, but we could train them up to that. Often what happens is, nope, I need someone ready-made because we need to fill it this week. We just found out on Monday that we got to notice to proceed and we have to be in the field by next week. So we need to find people we could just throw out there right now. So on a project-to-project basis, you are sort of the clone ninja. You're just thrown out there as a piece of the puzzle. And often it's up to sort of the individual to sort of like take the opportunities that are presented there as sort of training up opportunities. And if you have good field directors, good crew chiefs, good PIs, who are also then going to split their time while they're out there in the field and to sort of give you that next level, begin introducing you to that next level training so that you're able to, on future projects, do some, maybe put you in a direction to do some GIS work to put you in a position to someday become a crew chief in this. But it's not the design of the work. The work itself is very, very closed into a single box. It's about achieving the goals in that box, and it is not forward looking. At all. So that's sort of the back and forth of like yes and no at the same time. The system is designed not to have you grow or to be anything more than what you were hired for at that time. But the people within that, if they're the right people, can help move you in that direction.
Yeah. And I think to a certain extent, part of that is because, you know, people aren't going to be kept around. And, you know, why would you train someone up for, you know, to work for someone else's firm, right?
Right, which is a whole different conversation. Because, you know, if we go to the other industries kind of conversation, this is what, you know, in retail, you would be trained up with the expectation that someday you would be able to run the cash register. But if somehow in CRM, it's not always seen as something on there. And part of that has to do with some of the stability of the job. If we're hiring techs as sort of gig workers, for lack of a better term.
Totally.
Project by project basis, and we don't see them as longer term employee assets, then it does become a field of specialist. And you sit around and wonder, but how do I get the specialized training? Well, by being a specialist. It becomes very circular at that point. How do you get it? By doing it. Like California archaeology. How do you do it? By doing California archaeology. Yeah. That's how you do California archaeology.
Yeah, and I used to always try to train people up. I very clearly would just tell my crew, my greatest day will be the day that I come out here and all I do is just sit in the truck and read while you guys do everything. But that never happens because, you know, as I would move higher, there was other stuff that I had to do. And even if I was in the truck, I was doing some other kind of work or something like that. And I never actually got to the truck because, you know, not all the people on the crew knew how to do all the things excellently. And I also used to force people who didn't like doing certain things to do them sometimes. And the only way that I ever figured things out is really early on, I started to do the things that people didn't like to do. So if I was on a crew where no one liked drawing profiles, I'd spend, you know, find the people who know how to do it, let them show me, and then I would, for that project, do the profiles, right? Or if people didn't like using the GPS, or people didn't really like, you know, filling out the health and safety forms and stuff, I would do those things. Well, so then I would, when I got to be in charge, I would make other people who didn't like doing them at least do it some of the time, right? So that they learned those skills and they moved on. Some people love to dig and they hate filling out the paperwork. Well, you know, those individuals need to spend more time doing that so that they don't have deficiencies. And I knew when it came to techs that they were going to go to another company. And so I always felt like it was my obligation to make sure that they had the skills so that they could get another job. Because if they don't have skills, they're not going to get another job.
Okay. Well, we've covered six topics very briefly. I think, like I said before, all of these could easily be turned into a full episode. The list of both topics we've covered and potential topics will be found in the show notes on the CRM Archaeology Podcast page of the Archaeology Podcast Network .com website. So be sure to check that out. You know, make comments on any of those. You know, if you want to hear more about any of these topics, let us know. We would be happy to, you know, push that forward and turn it into an entire show.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.archpodnet.com/CRM Arc Podcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about.
Thanks for everyone for joining me this week. Thanks for listeners for tuning in. And we will see you in the field. Goodbye.
Adios.
Bye.
This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
And I figure Chris can clean this up. Sorry, Chris.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.